I was sheriff of this county when I was 25 years old. Hard to believe. My grandfather was a lawman. Father, too. Me and him were sheriffs at the same time, him up in Plano and me out here. I think he's pretty proud of that. I know I was. I always liked to hear about the old-timers. Never missed a chance to do so. You can't help but compare yourself against the old-timers. Can't help but wonder how they'd have operated these times. The crime you see now, it's hard to even take its measure. It's not that I'm afraid of it. I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job. But I don't want to push my chips forward and go out and meet something I don't understand. A man would have to put his soul at hazard. He'd have to say, okay. I'll be part of this world.
The year is 840 AD, and Louis the Pious is dead. He had ruled for over 26 years, surviving two acts of penance, three rebellions, and countless other threats within and without his sprawling realm. Now, Charlemagne's crown passed to his grandson, Lothair. Twice, Lothair had risen up against Louis the Pious, and twice he had been defeated. Lothair was blessed with the good fortune of having a forgiving father, but not the great fortune of having no rival brothers. In his final will and testament, Louis the Pious reconfirmed his younger son Louis, known as Louis the German, as King of Bavaria, and his youngest son Charles, known as Charles the Bald, as King of Aquitaine. Lothair effectively got what was left, a long expanse of land stretching from the North Sea to the Mediterranean. He was smack dab in the middle of his two brothers, and his relationship with them was complicated, made all the more so because now they were meant to answer to him instead of their father. Little wonder then that before anyone had even finished mourning Louis the Pious, war broke out between his three sons, set off by Lothair's attempt to claim the entirety of the empire for himself. Meanwhile, a new threat loomed on the horizon. That very same year, in distant Ireland, a band of Vikings took the unprecedented step of seizing Dublin and wintering there. Soon, other Vikings would follow their example, though they turned their attention to greener pastures, whose inhabitants alternatingly referred to them as Northmen, or Danes, or, most interestingly of all, as Ashmen or Oscomani, because of the ash wood used for their dreaded longboats. With these dragon-proud marvels of medieval engineering, the Oscomani would sail up the Seine, Rhine, and Elbe into the trembling heart of Francia. It was as if an entire continent's bloodstream was suddenly infected with fear and despair. By the time the Ashmen's bloody work was finished, little would remain of Charlemagne's empire except a dismembered, gangrenous corpse, its bowels spewing forth kinglets in the words of a Benedictine monk who bore witness to it all. The monk had no way of knowing that these spore-like kinglets carried the germ of a new order and a new age, the age of feudalism. 7 years earlier, there had come a brief moment when Lothair succeeded in taking control of the empire from his father, Louis the Pious. But he had overreached, and his brothers made it clear that they were not willing to be his junior partners. Now, history repeated itself, with Louis the German and Charles the Bald banding together to oppose their older brother. Yet, the authors of the definitive book on the period, The Carolingian World, warn us against the notion that the conflict was inevitable. They said, quote, "The civil war of 840 to 843 resulted from fraternal suspicions and ambitions which had simmered throughout the 830s and now erupted unrestrained by any consensus on how power should be divided between members of the dynasty. The lack of consensus was not inevitable. Brothers, even royal brothers, do sometimes get on with each other, but the preconditions for discord had been created by the actions of the aging Louis the Pious himself. Driven by Louis's desire to carve out a kingdom for Charles the Bald, as well as his periodic need to punish his other sons for their contumacy, i.e. disobedience, by restricting their future share in power and territory, no fewer than 5 imperial division plans were promulgated between 829 and 839. End quote. It's worth adding that Louis the Pious's elevation of Charles the Bald meant that Lothair was joined by his nephew Pepin II. Since Pepin had been passed over as King of Aquitaine in favor of Charles, he saw the conflict as the golden ticket to claiming his birthright. For the next 3 years, this fratricidal conflict raged on, but its most decisive engagement came in its first phase. In 841 AD, the pivotal Battle of Fontenoy was fought, and it would haunt the Frankish psyche for decades to come. All 4 Carolingian claimants were present at the battlefield, and given the considerable human cost incurred, each of them was lucky to be able to walk away from it. The outcome was a Pyrrhic victory for the little brothers, Louis the German and Charles the Bald. Though we lack reliable estimates about the number of combatants and casualties, it is safe to say that the event was virtually unprecedented in these respects. That is, if contemporary reactions to the battle are any indication. Fighting on the side of Lothair, a Frankish warrior poet called Engelbert composed the following elegy. Quote, "When in the earliest morning, dawn cleaved the horrors of night. That was not the day of the Sabbath, but the cauldron of Saturn. The wicked demon rejoices in the breaking of peace among brothers. The hubbub of war resounds. A terrible battle arises on all sides. Brothers prepare death for brothers, uncles for their nephews, nor do sons do their duty to their fathers. There had been no worse massacre on the field of battle. Christian law is violated. Blood flows in waves, and in hell the maw of Cerberus opens with glee. The hand of Almighty God protected Lothair, who himself put up a valiant struggle. Had the rest fought like him, swift victory would have been won. But even as Judas once betrayed the Savior, so, sire, your generals abandon you in the struggle. Be careful, lest you be deceived like the lamb before the wolf." Fontenoy is the name the peasants give to the spring and village where Frankish blood was shed in slaughter and destruction. The fields shudder, the woods shudder, the marshes shudder. May neither dew nor showers nor rain fall on that meadow on which mighty men, seasoned warriors, were laid low and wept for by fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, and friends. End quote. This was a masterpiece of the Carolingian Renaissance, produced in Latin and fusing stylistic and mythological elements from Greco-Roman, Germanic, and biblical traditions alike. In other words, it was a piece that only a Frank could then create, with the right inspiration, of course. Such pitched battles as Fontenoy were rare in this era, and those that pitted Franks against one another were rarer still. Most dynastic disputes were resolved through the threat of violence, as opposed to the bare and naked use of it. Fontenoy was different, and in its aftermath, the desperate and defeated Lothair turned to plundering undefended settlements like some scraggly Alsatian cur sniffing for scraps. Lothair was someone who was willing to use anything and anybody to get what he wanted. He had demonstrated as much in his struggles against his father, and now he did so again by lending his support to the Stillinga uprising in Saxony. Their name translating to companions in Old Saxon, the Stillinga were hell-bent on reclaiming the rights and privileges that they enjoyed prior to Charlemagne's conquest of their homeland. Remarkably, the Stillinga uprising was the only popular revolt recorded in Europe between the 6th and 10th centuries. The key word is popular, meaning a revolt undertaken by the common people for a common purpose, in contrast to the many rebellions mounted in support of one pretender claimant or another. While the last such resistance movement was a 6th century tax riot against the Merovingians, the next one occurred under circumstances not dissimilar to those of the Stillinga, when, in the 10th century, the Ottonians were Christianizing the lands beyond the Elbe. The irony is that the Ottonian dynasty had Saxon origins, but that is a story for another time. For now, it suffices to say that popular revolts did not have a good track record in the Middle Ages. The Stillinga were summarily crushed by Louis the German, who had their ringleaders rounded up and executed before the rest of them were turned over to his aristocratic Saxon collaborators. In the summer of 843 AD, the Carolingians finally declared a truce, culminating in the so-called Birth Certificate of Europe, the Treaty of Verdun. This treaty confirmed the trifold division of the empire, and each constituent part, or kingdom, was now christened with a new name. Charles the Bald's kingdom became known as West Francia, roughly corresponding to the country of France. Louis the German's kingdom became East Francia, equating to, you guessed it, Germany. And lastly, Lothair's kingdom became Middle Francia, a future battleground for these same nations. Out of all the Carolingian claimants, Pepin II, the nephew of the three brothers, fared the worst. Although he was initially allowed to rule parts of Aquitaine under Charles the Bald, he would later be snipped out of the family picture completely. In a striking turn of events, reminiscent of Uhtred of Bebbanburg, Pepin II adopted the ways and practices of the Norse after escaping from a monastery that he was exiled to. It's safe to say that after that stunt, he wasn't invited to any more Carolingian family Christmases. With the conclusion of the Treaty of Verdun, Lothair remained emperor only in name, and the concept of Frankish subkingdoms was laid to rest. In addition to getting a new name, each successor kingdom also got its sovereignty, though the idea of a Carolingian empire was kept alive. This outcome was the culmination of a trend that began with Louis the Pious, under whose reign the imperial inspectors known as Missi Dominici had already stopped being sent to the increasingly autonomous subkingdoms. In each of these kingdoms, one of the emperor's sons ruled, enmeshed in a web of his own palaces, estates, and local connections, with these woven together through marriage alliances and the distribution of privileges and benefices. Unlike the emperors of ancient Rome, the emperors of Aachen had no professional standing army. Thus, the delegation of authority to blood-related subkings was a natural response to the Carolingian Empire's size. But even so, the system was known to backfire. Each time that Louis the Pious meddled in the affairs of one of his son's kingdoms, he ran the risk of provoking another rebellion. This is because Carolingian kings and aristocrats alike were self-interested. The kings longed for more autonomy, or for that ultimate prize, Charlemagne's crown, while the aristocrats longed for additional privileges, estates, and access to the man who could give them these things. In most regions, that man was no longer the emperor, but the king, so most aristocrats became royal dependents. This was a time in flux, when the feudal playbook was only just starting to be written, so the aristocrats of the empire were called a wide variety of names. Names like Fideles, the faithful, Potentes, the powerful, Illustres, the illustrious, Proceres, the near, and Vassi Dominici, the servants of the Lord. These names were used alongside more formalized titles of office, such as Dux for Duke, Comes for Count, and Marchio for Marcher Lord. Needless to say, these names carried the germ of feudalism, but there were nonetheless a couple of key distinctions between the aristocrats of this period and the later Middle Ages. First of all, Carolingian vassi, even those referred to as comites or counts, did not always hold land. Some spent almost the entirety of their lives in the orbit of the Carolingian family, only departing from their side to carry out ad hoc missions on their behalf. Secondly, as pertains to those who did hold land, the estates under their control were benefices, not fiefs. Technically, these were not hereditary possessions, but as the 9th century progressed, a kind of ossification took place. In imperceptible degrees, benefices became fiefs, and it became almost impossible to dislodge counts and dukes from their ancestral holdings. In truth, this process may have begun even earlier than that. Recently, scholars have shed light on the many continuities linking the Merovingian period to the Carolingian one, the composition of the nobility foremost among them. Traditionally, it was thought that the Carolingians wiped the slate clean, forging a new aristocratic order out of the mounted warriors who won them their great victories, a straightforward exchange of military service for lands and titles. While there were surely examples of this, it is now believed that more than a few Merovingian-era families succeeded in clutching onto power despite the change in Frankian ownership, a Dark Age version of the rich getting richer. The traditional explanation can also be squared with a new one, in the sense that furnishing oneself with a horse and armor was not something just anyone could do. It required considerable wealth and training to fight on horseback, as evidenced by the sort of maneuvers on display at the war games staged by Louis the German and Charles the Bald. One of their favorites was the medieval equivalent of chicken, with two horsemen racing toward one another at full speed before pivoting last minute to avoid a collision. This new understanding of the Carolingian aristocracy helps explain why Charlemagne's family went to such great lengths to justify their assumption of power from the deposed Merovingians. In effect, Charlemagne's establishment of an empire may have had much to do with simply proving to all the Franks why his family deserved to be on top. It is a testament to this family's success that for almost the entire 9th century, every outbreak of Frankish rebellion equated to a dynastic struggle. That is, no malcontent faction in any corner of the Carolingian kingdoms dared to suggest placing someone other than a descendant of Charlemagne on the throne. Compared to Louis the Pious' Ordinatio Imperii, with its insistence on an imperial overlord, the new status quo that developed after the Treaty of Verdun surprisingly proved to be more stable than what preceded it. While this new system did not preclude further conflict altogether, the Carolingians experienced nothing like the bloodletting at Fontenoy, at least for a while. One mechanism used to promote fraternal harmony was the series of summits that each Carolingian king regularly attended, during which disputes were addressed, compromises struck, and new treaties and capitularies drawn up. Between 843 and 887 AD, something like 70 summits were held. One of these summits, taking place in 847 AD, took the tone of a family therapy session. It was called to order in the following way, quote, concerning the peace, concord, and harmony of the three brother kings, that they should be united by true and not false bonds of love, end quote. That same year, Lothair wondered aloud about what devil had gotten into him and his brothers in the preceding decade to have made them behave so viciously to their father and to each other. As of now, it seemed that devil had been exorcised. But make no mistake, these were the same sly foxes as before, only now they had to play by the rules of a more subtle game. Its prize was the same one it had always been, and the remaining chapters of this family saga furnish us with plenty of examples of intrigue and intimidation being used in pursuit of that prize. The truth is that neither Lothair nor any of Louis the Pious' successors definitively gave up on the aspiration to recreate Charlemagne's empire, not just in spirit, but in the flesh. In Middle Francia, Lothair ruled for the next 12 years as the nominal emperor, the territorial integrity of his kingdom undermined by the Alps which cleaved Middle Francia in two. That is why Lothair left the governance of Italy to his son Louis, known as Louis the Younger. Crowned as co-emperor and king of Italy by the Pope in Rome, Louis the Younger's reign would coincide with fresh Saracen incursions into Italy, which reached as far north as the Eternal City itself. Although much is made of the era's Viking raids, those undertaken by Saracens were also a growing concern. The term Saracens was at this time a kind of catch-all term for Muslims, in this case, those who came from North Africa. In 846 AD, Rome was spared another sack by the Aurelian walls, which single-handedly prevented these Muslim raiders from inflicting a humiliating defeat on the very epicenter of the Christian world. In the wake of this raid, the Saracens, unfortunate enough to be captured, were forced into manual labor, ironically taking part in the construction of the Leonine Walls. These walls were the latest fixture to Rome's system of defensive fortifications, indicating that the successors to St. Peter had learned their lesson. They could no longer count on a Carolingian to save them. Nonetheless, the event prompted an aging Lothair to belatedly head to Italy, the last time he would do so. In his defense, he had been preoccupied with putting down a revolt in the nearby region of Provence, all while the Vikings raided his lands in Frisia. Clearly, things couldn't go on this way. In 855 AD, Lothair approached death at almost precisely the same age as his father, Louis the Pious, and he declared that his lands were to be divided three ways between his sons, thereby dissolving the unwieldy kingdom of Middle Francia. In addition to being nominal emperor, his eldest son, Louis the Younger, would be king of Italy. while Lothair's younger sons Lothair II and Charles would split his remaining lands between them. Charles, also known as Charles of Provence, died early, and his lands were further subdivided between the two brothers. Since he was only a child when he had ascended to the throne, reigning for not quite 10 years, Charles of Provence is not remembered for much. A regent ruled in his name, and despite the kingdom's southerly position, became the target of Viking raids. This because the Norse were capable of navigating not just the open sea, but rivers also. The drafts of their longboats were shallow, enabling them to operate with an unprecedented degree of mobility, even in the guts of the Carolingian Empire. By comparison to Charles of Provence, Lothair II's reign was a more memorable one. He ruled over a kingdom that did not yet have a proper name, though it eponymously came to be called Lotharingia. The lands of this kingdom were the ancestral power base of the Carolingian family, encompassing the vaunted city of Aachen. This aroused the old feelings of envy and avarice in his uncles Charles the Bald and Louis the German, both of whom sought to add their nephew's territories to their own. On top of that, Lothair II had marriage problems. His wife, who had the wonderfully Germanic name Tutberga, was unable to bear him children. It was a dilemma that was to recur time and time again during the Middle Ages, when monogamy became an unswerving European norm. Unlike past Frankish rulers, Lothair II could not simply take another wife or concubine to produce an heir. Times had changed. Even Lothair II's great-grandfather, Charlemagne, had to abide by this new standard, passing over his illegitimate male children and entrusting the realm in its entirety to the safekeeping of Louis the Pious. But Lothair II did have a mistress named Waldrada, who had already borne him children, so he made the annulment of his marriage his primary objective. After accusing his wife Tutberga of sodomy, abortion, conception through witchcraft, and for good measure, incest with her brother, Lothair II cruelly subjected her to a trial by ordeal, the medieval world's euphemism of choice for torture. In an age that predated modern judges and juries, trials by ordeal were used to determine innocence and hinged on the concept of divine intercession. Some involved straightforward duels to the death, while others incorporated the natural elements, namely water and fire. Depending on the occasion, the accused might be doused with boiling oil, submerged underwater inside a barrel, or forced to walk over hot coals. Sometimes, defendant and plaintiff alike participated in the ordeal. They might, for example, be instructed to make the shape of a cross with their arms, and the fate of the accused was determined based on which of these two parties could hold the position longer. Although there were attempts by Louis the Pious to abrogate the use of these trials, they would become a permanent fixture of the Middle Ages. In the case of Lothair II's wife, Tutberga, she was made to undergo a trial by boiling water. And after surviving the ordeal, she was proven innocent and allowed to walk away from it a free woman. Unsatisfied with God's judgment, Lothair II made a number of concessions to his relatives with the hope that they would acknowledge his children by Waldrada as the legitimate heirs to his lands and titles. For her own safety, Tutberga appealed to the Pope and took refuge in the court of her husband's uncle, Charles the Bald. Lothair II's marriage was consequently reconfirmed, and he was threatened with excommunication should he disobey. The next pope proved more pliable, and after Lothair II made a trip to see him, it looked like his marriage annulment would finally be granted. But on his way back home, Lothair II suddenly became ill and died. The Italian summer had bested him in a trial by fever. Because Lothair's children by Waldrada were considered illegitimate, his uncles Charles the Bald and Louis the German swooped down on his lands like two hyenas splitting the carcass of a bison. The result was the 870 AD Treaty of Meersen, the third major partition of the Carolingian Empire. Because Lothair II's brother, Louis the Younger, had been preoccupied with wresting control of southern Italy from the Saracens, he missed his shot to get a piece of Lotharingia for himself. Interestingly, there had come a moment during his conquest of southern Italy that the nominal emperor, Louis, was brought into contact with the Byzantine emperor, that other claimant to the legacy of ancient Rome. Because the Carolingian Empire was lacking in the way of a navy, Louis the Younger received a small fleet of ships from the curiously self-made emperor, Basil II. These ships aided in his conquest of the city of Bari, after which time the Byzantine emperor could not resist taking a jab at the moribund state of the Carolingian Empire, probably because he was annoyed with Louis the Younger's insistence on using the title Emperor of the Romans, something Charlemagne had been more tactful about. In response to the Byzantine emperor's diplomatic rebuke, Louis the Younger argued that the Carolingian Empire was in fact alive and well. His argument rested on the fact that each successor kingdom was still ruled by one of Charlemagne's descendants. This at a time when the ruler of the Byzantine Empire had no such illustrious ancestors to speak of. The rest of Louis the Younger's reign was spent following up on his successes against the Saracens and dealing with a turbulent noble based in Benevento. It was there that the emperor was treacherously imprisoned, released only on the condition that he never returned to take his revenge. The emperor had no choice but to honor this condition, another indication of the rising power of the aristocracy. In 875 AD, Louis the Younger died, survived by a daughter who, under Salic law, was not allowed to inherit the throne. As such, preparations had been made to hand the kingdom of Italy to his cousin, Carloman, the battle-tested son of Louis the German. But due to the last-minute intervention of Charles the Bald, this was not to be. After sweeping into Italy at the head of an army, the youngest of Louis the Pious' sons asserted control over the region and assumed the imperial crown. This was a considerable achievement, especially in light of the precarious position occupied by Charles the Bald at the start of his reign. Compared to his older brothers, who had been long established in their respective realms, Charles the Bald had assumed power in the westernmost portion of the empire, with little in the way of local connections or political clout. As king of West Francia, Charles the Bald had to grapple with an ascendant aristocracy, repeated rebellions, rival claimants, and increasingly frequent Viking raids. After mounting an unsuccessful expedition into the untamed region of Brittany, Charles was cowed into issuing a capitulary that made significant concessions to the clergy and nobility, who were becoming increasingly entrenched in their holdings. At a time when West Francia most needed a warrior king, Charles the Bald failed to deliver. Very much his father's son in these respects, he was more interested in studying theology, hagiography, and his family's history, even if his court was not nearly as brainy as Charlemagne's. In reading accounts of Charles the Bald's reign, one wonders how the old-timers would have fared. If either of his namesakes had been in his shoes, they have turned things around. Given the intense interest Charles took in his family's past, he no doubt asked the same question. But like with his father, we can say of Charles the Bald that he did his best. After the Vikings besieged Bordeaux in 847 AD, then under the control of Charles' nephew, Pepin, the king's arrival in the region allowed him to consolidate his control over it. In times as turbulent as these, one problem could often be used to solve another. That said, the Viking problem was fast becoming an intractable one. More than any other Carolingian kingdom, West Francia faced the brunt of the storm, even while it was mired in civil strife. There was this consolation, though. The Vikings had come to raid, not to settle. They had no grand designs to topple kingdoms or to dislodge the Franks from their homes. For the most part, they were chiefly interested in taking their loot and bringing it back to Scandinavia, where they waged their own power struggles. In a word, the Norse could be bought off or otherwise reasoned with, something known even during Louis the Pious' reign. That is not to say that they were, in the words of one satirical description, long-haired tourists who sometimes roughed up the locals. The Vikings were a terrifying bunch, and it came as an alarming development when they graduated from looting monasteries and emporia to sacking cities wholesale. Though they had not come to settle, the Vikings raiding Francia gradually extended their stays, wintering near their raiding destinations while taking advantage of the fact that the Franks were no longer the all-season campaigners that they used to be. In 845 AD, under the leadership of a certain Ragnar, who has been linked to the saga character Ragnar Lothbrok, the Vikings infamously sacked the city of Paris. In a breathtaking display of audacity, they held an entire city captive until Charles the Bald agreed to pay their ransom. 7,000 livres, the equivalent of 5,670 pounds, or 2,570 kilograms of precious metals. This was the first of a long series of such tributary payments. In total, the tribute rendered to the Vikings by the Franks amounted to tens of thousands of pounds of gold and silver, to say nothing of what was pillaged. Europe had a new breed of apex raiders. Accumulating such vast sums of tribute required Charles the Bald to use all his gifts in diplomacy and stewardship. Inevitably, he had to turn to the malcontent nobles of his realm to help foot the bill, much to their annoyance. In 858 AD, Charles the Bald's unpopularity was such that he was nearly dethroned by his brother, Louis the German, who made multiple attempts to take control of West Francia. The events of the following year probably didn't help Charles' case, when the common people living along the Seine and Loire got sick and tired of the non-stop Viking raids. A group of them banded together to resist the Norsemen. Though they proved successful against the Vikings, they had less luck with their countrymen. The Frankish annals tell us that these brave commoners were summarily slain by the more powerful people, referring to the aristocracy. It is difficult to say whether this was done in accordance with the king's wishes, but either way, it is a blot on his reign. That being said, in the last two decades of his rule, Charles cuts a more formidable figure, even if his policy of tributary payments continued and his designs on Lotharingia and Provence were only partly successful. Something like 500 administrative documents survive from the reign of Charles the Bald, dwarfing the output of most of his relatives. Clocking in at an average of 15 per year, it was a pace just short of Louis the Pious's. In perhaps the most famous of his capitularies, Charles the Bald ordered the organization of a cavalry division, the construction of fortified river bridges, and the prohibition of horse and weapon sales to the Norse. The topic of Frankish arms had already been an object of concern to Charlemagne, who at one point outright banned the export of weapons and armor. Amid the rampant violence of the 9th century, the swords, axes, and mail armor produced by the Franks were second to none. Enabled by large-scale iron production and a sophisticated web of workshops, some of which were located in the monasteries. By the close of the century, there were even brand names for certain Frankish swords. But even in this time of incessant conflict, Charles the Bald's attention extended beyond the military sphere to matters like coinage, estate management, and weights and measures. Once again, these were reforms reminiscent of those enacted by Charlemagne, not excluding a potentially counterproductive one, the forced demolition of unauthorized fortifications. It has convincingly been argued that this was a long-running habit of the Carolingians, who either willfully neglected or outright destroyed the forts dotting the empire's countryside, especially in those untamed parts of the empire that had rebelled against them. The Age of the Vikings laid bare the insidious effects of this policy, the unfortified countryside being much easier to raid than it otherwise would have been. Over time, the Frankish nobles seemed to have flouted any such policy, erecting forts and castles to protect themselves and their people from the Vikings and other threats. This observation fits hand in glove with the trend toward decentralization taking place in West Francia and elsewhere, a trend that culminated in the development of feudalism. However, in the case of Charles the Bald, it has recently been argued that his demolition orders referred not to permanent strongholds, but rather temporary field fortifications, chipping away at the traditional narrative. In any case, none of this meant that the King of West Francia ruled unopposed in the last two decades of his reign. In a callous act that echoed his father's most infamous deed, Charles the Bald had his own son, Carloman, blinded after a failed rebellion. Charles knew well what sort of backlash his father had faced for blinding a nephew. The fact he took such drastic action anyway suggests his youngest son, Carloman, was a serious threat to his rule. The rebellion had been Carloman's last-ditch attempt to gain secular authority after he was tonsured at the age of just 5, an early precautionary measure that proved fruitless. We now reach the twilight years of Charles the Bald's reign, and the events that followed proceeded at a breathless pace. Following the death of Louis the Younger in the year 875 AD, Charles successfully asserted control over Italy, and with it, the empire. But since his older brother Louis the German still ruled East Francia, Charles' control over the empire was only nominal. Soon, Charles declared his intention to renew the empire of the Franks and the Romans, and this seems to have provoked Louis the German to invade West Francia. But this invasion was unsuccessful, and by 876 AD, Louis the German was dead. This made Charles the Bald the last surviving son of Louis the Pious. After his brother's death, Charles was closer than ever to restoring the empire, taking the fight to the last remaining holdout, East Francia, only to be thwarted by Louis's sons at the Battle of Andernach. This was a battle on the scale of Fontenoy. Had Charles the Bald been successful, it would have been the first time since 840 AD that the empire was reunited in its entirety. In the event, the defeated emperor set his sights on Italy after the Pope in Rome, not quite giving up on the chimera of a swashbuckling Carolingian savior, asked for his aid against the ever-encroaching Saracens. Then, suddenly, in the year 877 AD, Charles the Bald drew his last breath in the crisp alpine air of Mont Cenis, the very same mountain passage crossed and recrossed by Pepin the Short and Charlemagne alike. Now West Francia passed to Charles' eldest son, Louis the Stammer, while Italy went to Carloman, not Carloman the blinded son of Charles the Bald, but Carloman of Bavaria, the eldest of Louis the German's sons. You may recall that it was Carloman who had been set to inherit Italy in the first place, until his uncle Charles the Bald swooped in and claimed the kingdom for himself. Many years ago, as a mere teenager, Carloman had fought beside his uncle and his father when they had been united against their older brother Lothair I. This had been the start of an impressive military career for Carloman, who later earned the nickname Bellicosissimus, meaning most warlike, or in the modern translation of historian Eric Goldberg, real ass-kicker. But Carloman was soon forced to grapple with the fact that even ass-kickers get old. Within 2 years, the 50-something Carloman suffered a stroke that rendered him unable to speak. Though he possessed an erudition that enabled him to fluently communicate through the written word, Carloman was forced to vacate power all the same, dying shortly afterward. His two kingdoms went to his brothers, Bavaria to Louis III, also known as Louis the Saxon, and Italy to Charles III, ignominiously known as Charles the Fat. Neither Louis the Saxon nor Charles the Fat had been named a king during the lifetime of their father, although each acted like one. The authors of the Carolingian world explain why this was, saying, quote, "Just as Charles the Bald had come up with a novel measure to minimize the inherent dangers of dynastic politics, the tonsuring of Carloman, so Louis the German improvised to prevent rebellions by refusing to crown his sons as kings." Louis and Charles were poachers turned gamekeepers, whose memories of the 830s made them wise to the ambitions of their own sons. Unfortunately for them, such constitutional niceties did not carry decisive weight. A century of Carolingian history had taught the sons of kings that they were kings themselves, whether they were given the title formally or not, end quote. Louis the German had undermined this half-hearted policy by giving his sons command over armies and territories in his realm, and these they used to repeatedly mount rebellions against their father. In case you're thinking that Louis could have circumvented such a problem by keeping his sons away from the reins of power altogether, consider the instructive example of Charles the Bald's tonsured son, Carloman. His confinement in a monastery had done nothing to prevent the outbreak of a rebellion in his name. Additionally, there were the realities of time and space. Though the Carolingian realm had fractured multiple times since the death of Louis the Pious, its successor kingdoms still tended to be too large for any one man to rule alone. Unlike the Romans and the British, the Franks did not have an empire with a clearly defined core periphery system. Aachen was no Constantinople or Baghdad, and after Louis the Pious, it traded hands frequently. Instead of a glittering seat of government, the Carolingian kings had an expansive real estate portfolio, their system of palaces, estates, and monasteries enabling frequent circuits around their respective realms. Louis the German is a prime exemplar of this type of itinerant ruler, traversing almost 1,000 miles during a marathon 3-month span of his reign. This period was spent arbitrating quarrels and holding assemblies, along with a healthy dose of game hunts and feasts, of course. But such a pace was not usually sustainable in the pre-modern era. That is why Carolingian kings needed trusted lieutenants who could act as their eyes and ears in the countryside, and the task fell most naturally to sons. Even if these sons were claimants to the throne and could mount rebellions by drawing on regional connections, populations, and resources, the calculus for a Carolingian ruler was pretty straightforward. Without a standing army, the only real alternative to supervising such a vast empire was giving chunks of it to non-relatives, which would have proved an existential risk to the Carolingians, conscious as they were of what their ancestors had done to the Merovingians. That is why we see the same cycle of rebellion, contrition, and piecemeal succession taking place in East Francia as elsewhere. After one failed rebellion, Charles the Fat unbuckled his belt of power in the display we know well by now, throwing it on the ground in a bid to gain his father's clemency, which he knew he would receive. Clearly, Charles the Fat was already a keen practitioner of the game, and the same is true of his brother Louis the Saxon. Both of them had cut their teeth fighting not just against their father, but alongside and independently of him against frontier peoples like the Danes, Saxons, and Slavs, against whom East Francia scored notable successes. This was the part of the Carolingian Empire most intimately connected to the newly revived European slave trade, which now hinged on the importation of Slavic peoples to the Byzantine and Islamic worlds. The Venetians, whose floating city passed back and forth between the nominal control of the Byzantines and the Franks, acted as the intermediaries in this intercontinental human trafficking operation. More than that, though, Venice was becoming a kind of intake valve for exotic luxuries trickling into Europe, fueling an incipient culture of conspicuous consumption among the Frankish nobility and clergy. There is even a story about a Frankish bishop who paid a whopping 3 pounds of silver for a spiced-up mouse, under the mistaken belief that this was some sort of Oriental specialty dish. East Francia is sometimes seen as the most backwards of the Carolingian successor kingdoms, partly for the reasons I have mentioned already, and partly because of its lack of capitularies. While it's true that its western counterparts had a more literate administrative culture, the rulers and officials of this easternmost Carolingian possession could nonetheless read and write in Latin. Furthermore, during the reign of Louis the German alone, something like 170 documents and charters were produced, even if capitularies were not among these. Instead, imperial ordinances were expressed verbally, and this did not preclude administrative efficiency. The silver coins minted in East Francia are testament to this, weighing exactly 1.67 grams apiece, the precise monetary standard imposed by Charlemagne. We can turn to the authors of the Carolingian world a final time to reassess the last half century. They wrote, quote, "Division and subdivision of territory, escalating internal conflict, ever-weaker leadership in the face of Viking invasion, increasingly autonomous aristocratic power, and rising disillusionment with the ruling dynasty, are the notes which form the baseline in this version of history. Posterity has therefore seen in the years 840 to 888, not the high period of the Carolingian Empire, but rather the birth pangs of nascent kingdom nations, such as France and Germany, ready to burst out of an anachronistic imperial straitjacket on a trajectory towards their modern destinies." End quote. Posterity may see things this way, but not the brother kings who then ruled. They thought not in terms of nation-states, but in terms of empire. Though neither of them succeeded in restoring Charlemagne's imperial creation, one of their descendants soon would. As mentioned already, the death of Louis the German's son, Carloman, meant that his brothers Louis the Saxon and Charles the Fat ascended to the thrones of Bavaria and Italy, respectively. But in less than 2 years, Louis the Saxon also died, leaving the kingdoms of Bavaria and Saxony alike to his brother, Charles the Fat. During the intervening period, Charles had been crowned emperor, and he was now on the cusp of bringing all the Frankish kingdoms under his rule. Only West Francia remained sovereign, where the late Charles the Bald's eldest son now ruled. Nicknamed Louis the Stammer, and ruling West Francia for just a year and a half, his dismissive sobriquet is nonetheless an unfair one. Throughout his life, Louis had, in various capacities, demonstrated at least some level of initiative against the local aristocracy, the Vikings, and, when necessary, against his father. He also sired two healthy and able sons, Carloman II and Louis III, who, after their father's death in 879 AD, ascended to the throne of West Francia as co-kings. A contemporary monk called the boys the Hope of Europe. But slapstick tragedy was to befall them. Louis died chasing a girl, having hit his head on a low door, and Carloman died chasing a boar, having accidentally been stabbed in the leg by his servant. These freak accidents happened within a span of 2 years, when both brothers had only been around 18 years old. Had either survived, he might have proved to be precisely the kind of warrior king that West Francia so desperately needed. If we were to pinpoint a definitive crisis of the Carolingian Empire, it would not be Louis the Pious' penance in 833 AD, nor even the Treaty of Verdun a decade later. Instead, the turning point came in the period we've just discussed, the 9-year span beginning with 875 and ending in 884 AD, when 8 of Charlemagne's ruling descendants died. Even if death was always close at hand in the Carolingian world, nobody could have predicted this. It must have been a shocking thing to witness for the Franks living through that time, something akin to the experience of being an American in the late 20th century and watching the Kennedy curse unfold. Even if their empire had split apart after the Treaty of Verdun, the Franks had known no rulers other than the Carolingians for over a century. The Merovingians had been deposed as far back as 751 AD, and for all the rebellions that broke out after the 780s, each was limited in its aims to placing a different Carolingian on the throne. It was in the close of the 9th century that all of that changed. A certain Bazo of Provence took advantage of the chaos to make a bid for the West Francian kingship in 879 AD, the same year that the young sons of Louis the Stammer ascended to the throne as co-kings. There was little basis for Bazo's claim, except for the fact that he was powerful, well-connected, and had married into the imperial family. Even in this late stage of the empire's story, the descendants of Charlemagne proved themselves fully capable of uniting against a common enemy, with the four remaining Carolingian rulers banding together to root out this pretender claimant. Though Bazo was defeated, we would see his like many times again in the years to come. Within only 5 years, only one of the Carolingians involved in the struggle against Bazo was still alive. This was none other than Charles the Fat, who now presided over a reunited empire. To describe what happens next, we can turn to the always eloquent, if at times unreliable, Edward Gibbon, who said, quote, "By the end of the 9th century, the dregs of the Carolingian race no longer exhibited any symptoms of virtue or power, and the ridiculous epithets of the bald, the stammerer, the fat, and the simple distinguished the tame and uniform features of a crowd of kings alike deserving of oblivion. By the failure of the collateral branches, the whole inheritance devolved to Charles the Fat, the last emperor of his family. His insanity authorized the desertion of Germany, Italy, and France. He was deposed in a diet and solicited his daily bread from the rebels by whose contempt his life and liberty had been spared. According to the measure of their force, the governors, the bishops, and the lords usurped the fragments of the falling empire. Some preference was shown to the female or illegitimate blood of Charlemagne. Of the greater part, the title and possession were alike doubtful, and the merit was adequate to the contracted scale of their dominions. Those who could appear with an army at the gates of Rome were crowned emperors in the Vatican, but their modesty was more frequently satisfied with the appellation of kings of Italy, and the whole term of 74 years may be deemed a vacancy. From the abdication of Charles the Fat in 888 AD to the establishment of Otto I in 962 AD, end quote. Gibbon's narrative is the traditional one, and his purple prose may even have helped shape it. Yet his characterizations of Charles the Bald, Louis the Stammer, and Charles the Fat were unfair. On paper, it seems a damning thing that while the first Carolingians had epithets like the Hammer and the Great, the last Carolingians were called Stammer, Fat, Bald, and other things. At times, these nicknames were harmless, maybe even ironical, as for example with Charlemagne's father, Pepin the Short. Given the height of his son, it is hard to imagine that Pepin was short enough to warrant such a nickname. Similarly, Charles the Bald was known to be very hairy. Again, those nicknames were probably harmless, but other nicknames deliberately undermined or unpeopled their bearers, as for example with Charlemagne's eldest son, Pepin the Hunchback. This little-known Carolingian princeling probably did have a humped back, but because of the unsuccessful and little-known rebellion he had mounted against Charlemagne, it may be that his infirmity was deliberately exaggerated and weaponized against him politically. Most Carolingian nicknames were not contemporary, and this includes Charles the Fat's nickname, which was given to him in the distant 12th century. The only physical description we have of Charles is that he was tall and blonde. Based on a careful reading of surviving sources, he actually cuts a competent and active figure, endlessly making the rounds across his empire in a vain attempt to keep it together through sheer force of will. In the end, the problems he faced proved insurmountable. Preeminent among them, his failure to produce a legitimate male heir. The one son he did have, Bernard, was born a bastard, and Charles was not able to legitimize him. All the same, the rules were now being rewritten. It was another Carolingian bastard, Arnulf of Carinthia, son of the so-called ass-kicker Carloman, who was responsible for deposing Charles the Fat. This is best understood as the product of acute pains rather than chronic ones like the Vikings, Saracens, and the growing entrenchment of the aristocracy. The aristocracy had been slowly entrenching itself for a while now, but the central issue was that they had gotten used to having a king in their backyard, enabling the kind of face time necessary to advance their own dynastic interests. Now there was a single ruler in charge of this vast empire, with no legitimate sons named as sub-kings. Suddenly, the nobles had none of the access that they used to have, which fueled discontent. Their uncertainty about who would follow Charles the Fat was the final nail in the coffin. For all his many circumambulations around the empire, it was simply too big for one man to rule alone. After being deposed and exiled to Alemannia, Charles sent his traitorous kinsman, Arnulf of Carinthia, the relic of the True Cross, a reminder of the oath of loyalty Arnulf had made him in sight of God. When he received it, Arnulf reportedly wept. 6 weeks later, the middle-aged Charles the Fat was dead. The entire deposition had been for nothing. A Latin poem entitled Vision of Charles the Great recounts a dream the old emperor had, one that foretold the fall of the empire. The dream demanded every ounce of erudition the emperor had. In it, he was accosted by a sword-bearer whose blade was engraved with four mysterious words. When he awoke, Charlemagne immediately recorded these words of ancient Germanic origin on the writing tablets he habitually kept by his bedside. He then took the tablets to his learned court so as to decipher the meaning of the words. These were the leading luminaries of the Carolingian Renaissance, the most brilliant minds in all the realm, but each of them was dumbfounded. The wisest, Einhard, suggested that it would be the sword-bearer himself who revealed the word's meaning. At that point, Charlemagne understood. He himself was the sword-bearer. The first word referred to the abundance Charlemagne had won, and the second to diminishing abundance after his death. The third word referred to avarice and oppression, and the fourth word to the end. This apocryphal dream seems to have been a popular yarn of fiction woven in the court of Louis the German, and its central theme of an empire whose fall was preordained has enraptured scholars ever since. More recently, a new story has emerged. Writing in Heart of Europe, a history of the Holy Roman Empire, Historian Peter H. Wilson says, quote, "There may be something of a bargain basement feel to the later Carolingians, but they were neither as inept nor as indolent as both contemporary critics and later writers maintained. Their real problem was not irresistible centrifugal forces of dukes and kinglets seeking independence, but their own inability to produce legitimate heirs." End quote. That is a simpler story than the others, but it rings truest. The same Benedictine monk who wrote of a disgorged realm spewing forth kinglets from its bowels reinforces the idea that the last Carolingians were neither as inept nor as indolent as they are often made out to be. This monk, Regino of Prum, ascribed the cause of Carolingian power struggles not to a lack of nobility, courage, or wisdom, but instead to the simple fact that none of them so outshone the others that the rest deigned to submit to his rule. In a word, too many little Charlemagnes in the kitchen. Had the last of them begotten a new generation to pass the torch to, the odds are that this dynasty and this empire would have survived. In the event, the dark places of Europe outlasted them, which is why, one day soon, the empire would return.
Maybe I'll go riding.
Okay.
What do you think?
Well, I can't plan your day.
I mean, would you care to join me?
Lord, no, I'm not retired.
Maybe I'll help out here then.
Better not. How'd you sleep?
I don't know. Had dreams.
Well, you got time for them now. Anything interesting?
They always is to the party concerned.
And Tom, I'll be polite.
All right, then. Two of them both had my father in them. It's peculiar. I'm older now than he ever was by 20 years. So, in a sense, he's the younger man. Anyway, the first one I don't remember too well, but it was about meeting him in town somewhere. He gave me some money. I think I lost it. The second one, it was like we was both back in the older times. And I was a horseback going through the mountains of a night, going through this pass in the mountains. It was cold and there was snow on the ground. He rode past me and kept on going, never said nothing going by, just rode on past. And he had his blanket wrapped around him and his head down. When he rode past, I seen he was carrying fire and a horn the way people used to do. And I could see the horn from the light inside of it, about the color of the moon. And in a dream, I knew that he was going on ahead. And he's fixing to make a fire somewhere out there in all that dark and all that cold. And I knew that whenever I got there, he'd be there. Then I woke up.